The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. A stroke leaves Democrats short in the Senate.
Right now, Mitch McConnell is the functional majority leader.
The Biden administration struggles with mask mandates.
There is no data that shows that masking kids in schools has been helpful.
Chris Christie explains his feud with President Trump.
Words matter, Hugh. Words matter under the law, words matter in politics, and words matter when they come out of the mouth of the President of the United States.
And a school in Portland, organized around only accepting a majority of students of color, raises questions of constitutionality.
Very few differences between the Ku Klux Klan's view of race and the left.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me, please, on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. New Mexico Senator Ray Lujan suffered a stroke 2 weeks ago, a story that managed to stay out of the news for days after. At just 49 years of age, Lujan is on the younger side of U.S. senators, so his sudden illness caught everyone off guard. Media reports are that Senator Lujan will make a full recovery and be back in the upper chamber in 4 to 6 weeks. But right now, an evenly divided Senate has, for the time being, become a functionally Republican majority. How that plays out in coming weeks is yet to be determined. Many have noted if Republicans were in control and Democrats had a sudden short-lived majority, they'd probably take full advantage of that medical emergency. But a stroke of 1 of 100 is a serious matter among friendships across the aisles. Not one Republican is anxious to exploit this. I spoke earlier this week with Jake Sherman of Punchbowl News about the delicate situation in the United States Senate and how Republicans can best handle this new temporary layoff.
With Lujan out for at least the next few weeks, Schumer can't move any nomination that requires 50 votes for 50 Senate Democrats to be present, which also means that reconciliation bills in whatever form are out as well. It's a huge deal, and you've got it. So now dial me in. What do you know about Senator Lujan's condition? Because America's media has not covered itself in glory in telling us this.
Well, it's a delicate situation, obviously, for the media and for other people, because he's obviously suffered quite a serious bout with, a stroke. But they told us last week that he'll be back within 4 to 6 weeks. I don't have any clue. I'm not a doctor. I haven't examined his condition. I don't know his doctors. But I remember we have two examples of senators who have been out with strokes before. That's Mark Kirk of Illinois, Republican of Illinois, and Tim Johnson, Democrat of South Dakota, both of whom had strokes while in office. And they both came back after several months' absence, is my recollection. But right now, Mitch McConnell is the functional majority leader, although he doesn't have the power to do anything. He has more votes. So if you look at what they could do, it's very limited. I mean, besides passing government funding, which they need to do in the next 11 days, I'm really not quite sure what they can do when it comes to just basic governing, the blocking and tackling of governing.
So, Jake, my question, are you skeptical of the information we have been given about Senator Lujan's return schedule?
I'm skeptical about everything, Hugh.
So, yeah, I know that. I am very skeptical. And I prayed for the guy this morning because stroke is tough. It scares me more than almost anything else. That's why I walk. So I don't want to have a stroke. And Mark Kirk and Tim Johnson are examples of why not. But it is of national interest. It is of great consequence to the Ukrainians. It is of great consequence to the Supreme Court, whether or not he's coming back. Doesn't somebody owe us a lot more information, like when Donald Trump went to the hospital?
Well, I will say this. We didn't find out until 5 days after he had the stroke. He has
Wow.
he had surgery to relieve swelling in his brain. So he's had brain surgery. And we asked Martin Heinrich, the other Democrat from New Mexico, senator from New Mexico, who was also in the House of Representatives. They both were in the House of Representatives. We asked him about his condition, and he kind of said, you know, you guys are ridiculous. You know, I'm not answering, blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I it would be nice to have a little bit more information for sure, because this is the health of a public official. Now, I had a very prominent Republican senator say to me the other day, they disagree with me. He has the right to his privacy. And if he was governor of a state, it would be different because he's in charge of a state. Senate, they view a little bit differently. But I mean, I think Democrats would like to know more. Democrats don't really know what's going on. And again, very serious.
Senators are very protective of senators. You and I both know that that's a club, and R&D don't matter much inside the club. They take care of each other. They love each other. They're friends. They know each other's spouses. And I'm not denying that at all. And normally that would be the correct response. But he isn't the president. He is the deciding vote on the majority in the Senate, though. Mitch McConnell is the de facto majority leader until Senator Lujan comes back. Am I right?
Yeah, he can't bring things to the floor necessarily, absent some, you know, bizarre procedural maneuver. And Schumer's going to have to keep a tight grip on the floor because he doesn't have the votes. So, you know, time is ticking, Hugh. I mean, we're in February of an election year, and let's say he's back in March. There's just a lot going on. I mean, as you noted, the Russia sanctions are absolutely gigantic. That's going to have to be worked out. Government funding is going to have to be worked out. So there's just a lot riding on Lujan's absence. And again, hope he's doing well, but there's a lot riding on it.
Okay, we've said that both enough that people will now understand when I say the media is not doing its job. If this was a Republican in a 50-49 Senate, the progressive left would be demanding that Chuck Schumer, you know, grab the gavel and take over from Majority Leader McConnell. I'm not suggesting Leader McConnell do that. I'm suggesting that the media needs to let us know how long the United States Senate is paralyzed. Because there is one option that I haven't seen the left argue for this yet, which is Senator Lujan resign, it's a Democratic governor, will appoint a placekeeper. When you're better, they will resign. And you can go back. I'll point you again. Isn't that the way forward?
Yeah, there's no reason he cannot do that. There's no and I would imagine that if it goes on for much longer, then that will have to be something that they talk about. There's no reason why Lujan can't step down. They can't appoint somebody. And then when he's better, he comes back. But again, we're only a week into this, and they say between 4 and 6 weeks. So we'll have to see. If it gets to 6 weeks and he's not back, then that's something we'll have to start asking people. And believe me, we're asking people every day. Very few people want to answer about it. They say it's mild, and I understand that. But you're right. The Senate is paralyzed at the moment.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has an unenviable task: defend policies that have sent President Biden's approval rating below 40%. At times, their press conferences drift off into Alice in Wonderland territory, as they did recently when discussing the effort to mask children. I spoke this week with Dana Perino of America's Newsroom and The Five. She also served President George W. Bush's press secretary.
I know you are like former President Bush and many other people. For example, Attorney General Ed Meese have never said a negative word about their successors. And so I'm going to play you a couple of Jen Psaki clips. And I don't expect you to say anything negative about your successor at the White House podium, but I want to talk about what your guardrails were. Here she is yesterday talking about red states allowing parents to decide whether to mask kids or not. Cut number 11.
Where we have great concern if a kid or a parent chooses to wear a mask, or a school district decides they should keep mask guidance in place, and there are leaders who are preventing them from doing that. That is the place in some other states. But our hope is that states, leaders, will look at the science and data about what's going on. They'll make decisions about local school districts. Local school districts have always made these decisions. That remains the case.
Now, that is not true. Local school districts have not always made these decisions in situations like this. But do you consider that to be responsive, Dana? Is that how you would have answered the question?
Well, no, because the policy would have been different, right?
Yeah.
So I think that one of the things when you talk about the analyzing successors, I always keep in mind, you know, the policy decisions that President Biden himself have made have really made things very difficult for her. And sometimes it doesn't even make sense, because there is no data that shows that masking kids in schools has been helpful. They cannot point to a single bit of CDC data on that. And we also know, of course, that Jen Psaki, sometimes she will say something that will then be proven not to be true, like 2 days later. For example, the Randy Weingarten of the teachers union communicating directly with the CDC to try to get them to do what she wanted. And it worked.
And it worked.
And now you have Randy Weingarten asking the CDC to help her get mask guidance taken off. I mean, I think that oftentimes the press secretary is kind of at the whims of the president. That's why I don't think it would have ever happened to me, because the policy seemed to make sense to me. Maybe the policy makes sense to her and she's trying to do her best to try to present that. But I often think that the president and Ron Klain, the chief of staff in particular, always put her in a really tough position.
So this goes to the job. Tony Snow is a friend of mine, except when he tried to steal Dwayne back when he started his radio show. But I've known Tony forever. And I've known a lot of press secretaries. I think they have faithfully tried to understand the opposite point of view. And if not to give it a persuasive representation from the podium, not to distort it. Was that your approach?
Absolutely. Well, a couple of things. One, I always made sure that, and I believe this in my heart, I believe this to this day, that I was not the spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. There was a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. I was the press secretary for all of the United States of America. And I keep that very much in mind, because the reporters will try to ask you so many political questions. And of course you have to stand up for the president and the party, but you'd have to do it on the merits while also being understanding. I always used to try to do something, Hugh, which is absolutely not just pay lip service to understanding the other's point of view, but to actually understand it and then do a better job of arguing and persuading the point that I wanted to make to try to advance the conversation that way. And that means you just work constantly. One thing I didn't have, though, and I think it would have been a blessing and a curse, you know, there was no Twitter when I was press secretary. It had just started.
You're right.
Huh. And it had just sort of gotten started. And I think I would have been even more informed, but also probably even more angry.
You know, it has changed the Beltway Manhattan media bubble fairly significantly. Now, Dana Perino, let me go to this next point of view about how you can become a news person out of the job. You are a very good news person. Tony Snow became good news person because people trust you, because you did not screw the other side when you were the representative of the United States standing up there. You did not distort. You might not have made their case for him, but you did not distort. If you did not misrepresent, you will be credited with credibility. Is there any way for Jen Psaki to get back what I think she has given away, which I don't play her audio. I just don't play it. It's just talking points.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what she wants to do long term. If you were to ask me when I was a kid, what did I want to be when I grew up? This is my ultimate dream job. I get to be on the newsroom. Then I return to provide some analysis and commentary on the Five. And that would have definitely been my dream job. But thankfully, I took this circuitous route and ended up at the White House to learn a lot about government and leadership, management, and a lot about myself, frankly.
Coming up, my conversation with Governor Chris Christie.
Words matter, Hugh. Words matter under the law. Words matter in politics. And words matter when they come out of the mouth of the President of the United States.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Former Governor Chris Christie made headlines this week when he accused President Donald Trump of trying to overturn an election and blamed him for the Capitol riot. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show and took those words a step further. We began with his appearance on ABC's This Week with host Martha Raddatz.
Well, look, Martha, I think that the actions the vice president took on January 6th spoke loudly, and I'm glad he's finally put words to it. I don't know why it took him so long, but I'm glad that he did. And let's face it. Let's call this what it is. January 6th was a riot that was incited by Donald Trump in an effort to intimidate Mike Pence and the Congress into doing exactly what he said in his own words last week, overturn the election. Now, he's tried to do a cleanup on aisle one here and correcting that stuff, but it's not going to change. He actually told the truth by accident. He wanted the election to be overturned. Donald Trump did respond to what the vice president said. And I think it's kind of akin to the kid standing in the corner holding his breath. You know, it's immature and it's beneath the office that he held.
So, Governor, did the former president call you yesterday?
He did not.
Do you expect a call soon?
You know, you never know, Hugh. He's knowing him for 20 years and being his friend for 20 years. You never know when you're going to get a call or you're not, when he's upset about something. But look, what I said yesterday is the truth. And my biggest concern about all this is, while Joe Biden and his administration is doing things to this country that may be undoable, and Republicans should be solely focused on that, we still got the folks at the RNC focusing on this stuff. And then all weekend, we have commentators asking us these questions, and rightfully so, because of the actions of the RNC. We as a party should be focused on our plan for the future and how we're going to change and stop what Joe Biden's doing to this country.
Now, Governor, the RNC did a lot of things, and we'll come back to that. I want to focus on the legal issue that maybe Martha didn't hear you say. Incite is a legal term. Do you think actual and proximate causation of the riot and the people who trespassed into the Congress, does causation flow to the president, former president?
Look, I think due to his conduct, Hugh, not on January 6th necessarily, but the conduct from election night forward, I think when you're going to hear testimony from many of those folks who were up there, they're going to tell you they went there because that's what Donald Trump told them to do. And so I think he's got an issue in that regard. There's no doubt. Now, is it a slam dunk? It is not. As is always the case, as you know, with these type of issues. But to me, it's less important as a legal issue than it is as a policy and political issue.
Well, I agree with that, but you've got legal chops. Very few people do. I can talk to you, Pompeo, Cotton, and DeSantis about the law. So I want to talk to you about the law. Is he liable? Is he potentially liable for any wrongful death action or damages done to the Capitol in tort?
He's potentially liable for that, although I think he's down on the causation chain from the folks who were actually there and committing the acts of violence.
Do you remember Paul's graph?
Yes.
Okay, where is he on the train track?
Look, I think that the conduct that happened was foreseeable, given that he's been telling people you've got to fight for your country and go up to Capitol Hill and fight for your country. You know, words matter, Hugh. Words matter under the law. Words matter in politics. And words matter when they come out of the mouth of the President of the United States.
Do you think he intended the 725 people who have been charged with one crime or another to break into the Capitol?
I don't think he intended that specific act, Hugh.
He's told me he didn't. He's told me on the air that he didn't.
I don't think he intended that, but I think what he intended, and his words this past week support this, that he was attempting to set up a situation to intimidate Mike Pence and intimidate the members of Congress into voting to overturn the election. His words, overturn the election, Hugh.
Okay, and what was his speech?
Words.
Was his speech protected under the Brandenburg test?
I believe his speech was protected. I believe his speech was protected. That's why I say that when you look at the causation chain, him saying the things he was saying from Election Day forward is what causes the problems.
All right. Now, I want to switch over to the former vice president's statement. I want to play it for people. Cut number 11 from the Federalist Society last week.
President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election.
Is Mike Pence right on the law?
Yes, he is.
Is there any doubt in your mind?
Not a scintilla of doubt in my mind.
Didn't all this craziness begin in 2000, get worse in 2004, and metastasize in 2016 so that it became the 2020 riot?
I think all of those things were, what I talk about is, the Democrats started this in 2000 by calling George W. Bush an illegitimate president. And they're the ones who began down this road.
Hear the rest of my conversation with former Governor Christie? Go to townhallreview.com. A new school in the city of Portland, Oregon, recently announced that they will be accepting mostly BIPOC students, that is, black and indigenous people of color. This setup is patently unconstitutional, but it has not led to a stop by the leaders of Portland. Here's Salem host Dennis Prager.
Charter school for BIPOC students opening in Portland. BIPOC is black, indigenous people of color. Portland has been labeled the whitest big city in America. That can make it difficult for some BIPOC kids to see themselves reflected in their communities and schools. Well, what does it mean? It can make it difficult for some BIPOC kids to see themselves reflected in their communities and schools. What does that even mean? You need to see yourself reflected? It's important? That's important? That's why there's an effort to make a space specifically for BIPOC students where they feel seen, heard, and their experiences are reflected in curriculum. So they're going to create a BIPOC school in Portland. The Ku Klux Klan would support this completely. A very few differences between the Ku Klux Klan's view of race and the left. Very few. They believe in racial separation. They both believe in white supremacy. Yes, I'll give you a perfect example. At Princeton, the ballet group said that, this is literally what they said, Princeton students. This is the policy of the Princeton Ballet Company, that perfectionism is white supremacy. It's exactly what the Ku Klux Klan would say. Whites believe in perfectionism and are therefore superior. Every spring we match our kids or mentees with mentors, and we have more kids wanting to get mentorship than we have mentors, and they have to be of the same color. I don't know, does this have to be reflected in everything? Should a non-BIPOC go to a BIPOC doctor? What if you're not reflected in your doctor? Why would a male go to a female doctor or a female go to a male doctor? They're not reflected. The bored, wealthy, the bad combination. That's what produces leftism, boredom.
Coming up, Larry Elder on the N-word.
The rule is, there's a rule. No one really understands the rule.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, friends. This is Katie Pavlich from townhall.com. The liberal media and big tech are working overtime to promote the left's anti-American agenda and silence me and the reporters on our team at Town Hall. We have to bring the truth to the American people, free from the spin of big media and the censorship of those big tech companies. We're constantly covering the news that matters, exposing the COVID lies, the leftist rot and crime surge in our cities, the illegal alien crisis at our southern border, and all of Joe Biden's unconstitutional overreach, including the critical race theory attacks on our children and grandchildren by school boards and the Department of Justice. I hope you'll support our vital team of conservative journalists today. You can do so by going to townhallaction.com. While cancel culture and big tech comes for us, the direct support of our VIP members helps make us uncancelable. Please join our team by becoming a VIP member at townhallaction.com. That's townhallaction.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The controversy surrounding Joe Rogan took a complicated turn this week when those looking to sink him found a series of past podcasts where he used the N-word. An apologetic Rogan, and an apology was necessary as that word is never really appropriate, said that he was disturbed by his own past willingness to say what he did. Salem host Larry Elder discussed the use of that word.
So let me try to understand what the rule is. The rule is, there's a rule. No one really understands the rule. It's full of exceptions, inconsistencies. Bill Cosby used to chastise black comedians for using the N-word while he was drugging women in order to sexually assault them. But using the N-word was bad. And Richard Pryor, of course, used to use the N-word all the time. I saw him when I was in college. He was on the Johnny Carson show, and he used the N-word. And my roommate and I got into a debate about that. I didn't like it. And my roommate said, well, what's the problem? I said, normalizing the word by going on Johnny Carson at night and just dropping it? I said, that I got a problem with that. My roommate didn't, who's also black. And then later on, Richard Pryor apologized for using the N-word and said he wasn't going to use it anymore. Now, Al Sharpton, who's got a show on MSNBC, has made a bunch of anti-Semitic comments, falsely accused a white man of raping Tawana Brawley, never apologized for it. Once called the first black mayor of New York, David Dinkins, an N-word whore, except he didn't say N-word. He's got a show on MSNBC. You know who else got a show on MSNBC? Joy Reid. Joy Reid has a blog, made all sorts of homophobic posts, accusing people like Tom Cruise of being gay, accusing the former senator of Florida of being gay. No evidence whatsoever, said she found the idea of two men kissing disgusting. She was a 9/11 truther. Did you know that? Put a bunch of posts there saying that 9/11 was an inside job. I kid you not. I kid you not. Joy Reid on MSNBC right now. And when the homophobic post surfaced and the hideous things she said about other people surfaced, she said, I don't believe I wrote them. I was hacked. So NBC hires a forensic expert to look into whether or not she was hacked. She wasn't hacked. And then she apologized. And then more surfaced. And she said she was hacked again. And then apologized again. She's got a show on MSNBC. Maybe I should put a compilation of some of the things she said and put it up on there on YouTube. Barack Obama used the N-word in his book, Dreams of My Father. And there's also a book on tape. And Obama is the person that did it. I've got a book on tape, Dear Father, Dear Son, but I'm not the one who did the reading. Somebody else did it. So Obama did his own narration. Use the N-word. You can go online and hear Obama saying the N-word. Remember Larry Wilmore at the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Drop the N-word. D.L. Hughley uses it in his act. Chris Rock has a whole routine about the difference between black people and the N-word, and everybody laughs. But when Bill Maher used the N-word in a joke, which I thought was funny, frankly, he got chastised by Ice Cube, who uses the N-word in his music. So, I'm not quite sure. And as I mentioned, Kanye West, in a song called Gold Digger, uses the word throughout the song. And at a concert, he gave them, quote, temporary permission, close quote, to use it. Now, I think that permission expired when you got into the lobby or got into the parking lot, or maybe when you got home. I'm not quite sure when the temporary permission expired, but you did have temporary permission, at least inside the concert hall, to say that, even though it's offensive. It wasn't offensive when you're singing it along with a song that was number one song for Kanye West. So it's a little confusing, isn't it? Rappers, not a problem. Comedians, Cat Williams, very funny comedian, uses it all the time. D.L. Hughley certainly has. Dave Chappelle certainly has. And Dave Chappelle, look at his specials. Majority of the people in the audience appear to be white. There he is, dropping it. People are laughing. So is it okay to laugh at it as long as you don't use it yourself? Is that the way the work? Meanwhile, crime up, shootings up. Half of the homicide victims in this country are black. Let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about what happened last weekend in Chicago. Let's talk about Joe Rogan and a compilation over 12 years taken out of context of him using the N-word. Really?
Coming up, some churches follow the politics of COVID.
This is not a good sign about the state of religion. It is not.
Dennis Prager, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
4 years ago, China expert Stephen Mosher warned us about the rising threat of Chinese totalitarianism. 4 years later, the threat from China has grown exponentially. Yet in spite of China's relentless violations of human rights and dignity, China is being honored as the host of the Winter Olympics. Read the unvarnished truth about China you won't see during the Olympics. Get Stephen Mosher's fully updated book, Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order, available at Amazon and wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Vaccine mandates have been the controversy of the year. The Supreme Court handed a big loss to the Biden administration after they said that private businesses cannot be forced to mandate vaccines en masse. And the truckers of Canada become heroes to millions on both sides of the border as they protest similar demands from their government. Governments unchecked by constitution and law naturally tend to grow larger and to seek more power. Mandates have found their ways into other places of our lives. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager looks at the trend of some churches that turned away the unvaccinated.
A very big problem has been the behavior of churches and synagogues, and we'll throw in Mormon temples. Church, Christian, Protestant, Catholic, Mormon, Jewish have not showered themselves with glory these past 2 years, acting in most cases, the vast majority, like secular sheep. This is not a good sign about the state of religion. It is not. As I've come up with the saying, I don't care what religion you're in, as long as you're embarrassed by it. I'm embarrassed by the behavior of many of my fellow Jews. You should be of your fellow Christians, Catholics, Mormons. And certainly the leadership, which has shown no leadership. If religious people are obedient to irrational, that's the key, irrational secular authority, where is our hope? It's as simple as that to me. I have this belief that religious people should be better. If they're not, religion is useless, totally useless. If you are indistinguishable from a secular sheep, what is the good of your religiosity? You have a moral duty as a religious person to seek truth. If you know nothing, and you have to know nothing about vaccines and about masks to really believe that they are working, when far more people died in America in the year of the vaccine than died in the year of no vaccine. I mean, is that not dispositive in some way? Daily Wire, powerful piece. Neither vaccinated nor unvaccinated. How churches imposing vaccine mandates are dividing Christians with, quote, a different gospel. Anyone over 12 years of age who wants to attend Episcopal worship at St. Peter's in Rockland, Maine, St. Luke in the Fields in New York, or Grace Cathedral in San Francisco will have to show vaccine passports. So will anyone looking for fellowship at Atlanta's Greater Piney Grove Baptist. Those not prepared to provide proof of vaccination will be asked to provide a doctor's note explaining why they can't get the shot. Because the FDA has yet to approve COVID inoculations for youngsters, anyone 11 and under isn't even allowed into the building. What a great message to children, isn't it? Though none of you die from this, you can't even come to pray, because we at the aforementioned churches, Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, St. Peter's in Rockland, Maine, St. Luke in the Fields in New York, and Greater Piney Grove Baptist in Atlanta, we do not follow truth. Even though we are told that the truth will set us free, we're okay with fraudulent orders. In fact, we're not just okay, we believe in them. Grace Cathedral's pastor told Deseret News that even though no government regulation compelled his church to require vaccines, he ultimately wanted to emphasize, quote, health over accepted traditions. How's that? That's the pastor of Grace Cathedral. This has been 2 years of proof of something I have said for all of my adult life, the secular world has influenced religion far more than religion has influenced the secular world. The sheep-like behavior of churches and synagogues during the COVID lockdowns, etc., are proof. It would be easy to assume mandates are only cropping up in churches that proudly fly rainbow flags and hang Black Lives Matter banners in their sanctuaries. But that is hardly the case. No one could accuse Calvary Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, one of the largest non-denominational evangelical churches in the country, of leaning left politically or theologically. Yet last month, in a memo shared with the Daily Wire, Chief of Staff Jordan Shaw announced that for the safety of preschoolers, employees in the Child Development Center would be required to get the vaccine. Safety of kids under five. More of them have died of drowning than of COVID. His announcement minced no words, saying, quote, for those who choose not to comply with the vaccine requirement and those who refuse to disclose their decision by October 8th, we will consider that you have voluntarily resigned. Sounds exactly like American Express, right? Or Verizon, or Coca-Cola, or Disney. And this is an evangelical church. Of what use is his Christianity? Of what use? Well, it gives the guy employment. That's a biggie. I'm not kidding. Has it shaped his pursuit of truth? Of course not. Despite the fact that children face extremely minimal risk from COVID exposure, Calvary offered no exceptions for the young. Female teachers who made up approximately half the staff, some of whom had objections based on the new vaccine's still unknown long-term impact on fertility and pregnancy. So young women, an evangelical church, forced, fired, or get the vaccine. The result of this gauntlet throw, dozens of families who relied on Calvary for child care were left in the lurch due to caregivers who quit rather than comply. Is this a joke? One mother wondered when told she'd have 2 weeks to make other arrangements at a time when daycares have miles-long waiting lists. How in the world can they treat us like this? Because they're indistinguishable from non-religious people. The only reason that more Republicans are troubled by vaccine mandates is because they value freedom and truth more than the left does. That's it. That has nothing to do with politics. It will come out one day that you were deceived about masks, obviously, and about vaccines. It will come out, especially for children. And I wonder what will happen.
Coming up,
GoFundMe was going to steal $10 million.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Albert Mohler with lessons from West Lafayette, Indiana, and an abandoned effort to pass a law that would have directly impacted religious liberty.
There is still, at this point in this culture, an opportunity to press back. And woe to us if we do not.
And standing firm in the face of the coming cultural tsunami.
God will use us to turn back the tsunami and make it not a tsunami of opposition and judgment, but a tsunami of opportunity and awakening. And that's what I'm praying for.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As the truckers in Canada rebelled against vaccine mandates, thousands of them had their livelihoods threatened as they began what they dubbed the Freedom Convoy. To help the truckers, a GoFundMe account was launched and quickly raised millions of dollars. But GoFundMe, which has a history of favoring leftist causes, froze the account. Then they took their politics a startling step further. Salem host Mike Gallagher explained.
This is a pretty extraordinary story. Apparently, on GoFundMe, Americans are so inspired by watching Canadian truckers take to the streets of Canada to protest the unconstitutional overreaching mandates and restrictions for vaccines. Do you know that people donated over $10 million to GoFundMe to help these truckers? Do you know what GoFundMe did? They took it down. They claimed the reason it was taken down was because the protests, the Canadian truckers' protests, were no longer peaceful. So they shut down the Freedom Convoy, and GoFundMe donors were told they would have to fill out a dedicated refund form to try to get their money back. Otherwise, the funds would be sent to a charity determined by GoFundMe. GoFundMe was going to steal $10 million. $10.4 million. They were going to redirect the monies to charities of their choice. Wonder who that would be. Might that be Stacey Abrams' organization? Maybe Al Sharpton would get a nice big chunk of the change. Wonder what's an approved GoFundMe charity. And Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, is livid, as he should be, as every elected representative should be. They're on the warpath. Now it's been announced that a number of states' attorneys general are beginning an investigation into GoFundMe's standards and practices. Here's Senator Cruz in response.
And the thieves in Silicon Valley decided, we don't like your politics, so A, we're going to take your money, and then B, we're going to give it to people we like. Listen, if anyone else did that, that is called theft. And so today, I sent a letter to the Federal Trade Commission asking that the FTC open an investigation into GoFundMe into whether they've committed deceptive trade practices. Because when people gave money, they gave money under the promise it would go to the Freedom Convoy, not to whatever left-wing political ideology GoFundMe and other Silicon Valley companies support. They are deceiving consumers, and it is wrong.
This has got to stop. If this doesn't stop, we're going to lose our country.
Thank you for joining us on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thank you once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.